So we have been talking about small groups. We're studying a book together called Why Small Groups. And it's my attempt this morning to try and help answer the question, why? Why small groups? And I will just say that in a nutshell, the reason why small groups matter is not so that you would sign up for one of our groups and make sure you plug into one of our programming things and so you help develop our church and develop our... That's not it at all. Honestly, it's not. It's trying to model something I think that in American church has been... it's just been an oversight for too long. And the model is set for us in Acts chapter 2 when the church was born, and it describes the church in this way. They met regularly in the temple in a large group, but then it says they also met regularly in each other's homes where they shared meals together, so in a smaller setting. And so the idea of church being just something you do on Sunday and then go home and you're not connecting in relationships with other believers throughout your week and just the normal part of your day-to-day thing is just not okay. And so we're trying to foster that kind of community among us. And one of the, you know, ways that we have is this small group stuff that we've set up. And if that's a thing that would help you, that would assist you in connecting and plugging in, then by all means, take advantage of it. And if you're not in a small group and you're like, well, I'd like to be, let us know here at the church. We got all kinds of groups that are meeting at different times throughout the week, and we'd love to get you plugged in. But that's kind of what we're talking about today is, again, we're in our third week out of seven. So after today, we're almost halfway through. We're in our third week out of seven talking about a book edited by a guy named C.J. Mahaney. And the book is called Why Small Groups. And in chapter 3 of the book, he opens with a discussion between renting and owning. And if you've read the chapter, you may remember, he talks about the difference between renting a car and owning a car. And one of my very best friends, who I will tell you is a pastor at Countryside Church, his name is Mark Furr. His cell phone number is 605-6... Okay, I better not tell you that. But every time I travel and get a rental car, he wants to know, he wants a photo of what car I've rented. It's just a thing between guys. We like cars. And so he wants to know what kind of a car did I get. And then he always will tell me things like this. Just remember, no car goes faster or jumps higher than a rental car. But there's lots of law enforcement people in our audience here this morning, and so I'm not going to talk about that. But I'm just kidding. But I will tell you that when my wife and I got married a long time ago, we lived in married student housing at the college because I still had 1 year of college left. So I got married between my junior and my senior year. And so we lived in married student housing. And at the college that we went to, I mean to tell you, these apartments were very small. We had some people that lived above us that loved to play music and watch movies at odd hours, and you could hear everything going on. We had people that lived the floor below us that loved to fight a lot, and you could hear a lot of everything. And so apartment living, if you are in an apartment, my heart goes out to you because it's challenging to live in an apartment. But I will tell you that the carpet in this place was absolutely outdated and worn badly. It's a college. It's a Bible college, small private school. They didn't have a lot of money. The faucets in the bathroom tended to drip. Like I said, the walls were paper thin. The windows were horrible. They leaked air, and we were in Minnesota where it gets cold. And so our bedroom window was not very well insulating. On and on and on. And we literally put $0, not a penny, into the place other than we paid our rent. We weren't interested in updating the carpet or getting, you know, fresher linoleum that didn't have cracks and stuff in it. We just lived in it because it wasn't ours, and we just were thankful to have a roof over our head, right? But then the day came when we finally moved to Hartford, South Dakota, after several years of being married. We were getting out of the rental life, and we went to buy our own house. Found a house in the Sioux Falls Argus Leader classifieds that someone was selling by owner in Hartford, 400 East 3rd Street, and the price was $75,000. And I remember thinking to myself as a 20-something-year-old going like, that is so much money. How are we ever going to afford to pay a $75,000? That's ridiculous. Who could afford a $75,000 house? Wouldn't you love to have even just a $75,000 lot? Yeah. So when we bought this house, we immediately started investing more money into it. We needed to add a bedroom, and the basement was unfinished, and so we did some finishing in it, put carpet down there. Why did we do that? Is it because we all of a sudden came into lots of money? No, we didn't have a lot of money, but what little we had, we were putting into it because it was our house. Our three boys were going to live in it. We had guests coming to stay with us. We wanted them to have a spare bedroom that they could sleep in. So we're buying furniture, and we're doing all this updating and painting and doing all decorating and all these things. Stuff we never worried about when we were renting the apartments, right? But all of a sudden, what shifted? What shifted is we were the owners, and we were the benefactors of all the investments and the improvements and things that we put into the house. And when we went to sell that house, $75,000 didn't seem like a lot of money anymore, right? So the difference between renting and owning, and that's what this chapter in our study talks about, is there's a big difference. And when it comes to the things of church, so many of us think of church as renting and don't feel like we have any stock in the deal. We really don't. We just kind of rent space. And if we kind of get tired of the carpet, or we get tired of the people, or we get tired of the preacher, or we get tired of the music, or we get tired of the whatever, the drama, we just go rent another space. And that's the way our world has, in our culture, has operated for so long. But the long-term effects of living that way does great damage to your soul, because to walk with Jesus in a real and personal relationship, in order to do that, and in order to grow in your relationship with Jesus, to mature, we talked about this 2 weeks ago, one of the purposes of small groups is maturity. In order for us to grow in our relationship with Jesus, it requires other people to help us with our blind spots, right? And so if we're going to mature in Christ, we need community. We need people in our lives who would help us say, you got something on your right here, right? We need people in our life that help us see those things. But when we don't see our owning or our investment into church culture, and we see ourselves as just renting a space, basically just taking instead of offering something, it does damage to ourselves personally and spiritually. And then the work, the overall work and ministry of the Holy Spirit in our community as a church, but also in our community at large, impacting the world around us, which is desperate for hope and truth and peace and joy, right? Our impact is so much smaller because we're not healthy. So why small groups? Because we want to see all of us growing in Jesus. And this is what it means to be part of a church. So we're going to talk about why small groups this morning and the difference between renting and owning. So I want you to turn to 1 Timothy chapter 4, because we're going to look at about four verses out of 1 Timothy chapter 4 this morning. So it begs the question, when you see something like 1 Timothy, is who's Timothy? And why was this written to Timothy, this letter? Why was it even written to Timothy? Well, Timothy was a young pastor, and it was this letter was written by Paul, who was at that time an old guy. And he was writing to encourage this young guy to stick with it. Don't give up. Continue to serve right where you're at. I know it's hard, but don't quit. That was kind of the gist of why Paul was writing this letter to this young pastor. And in chapter 4, Paul writes some interesting things here in verse 12 that I think you will help explain some of this difference between renting and owning, and maybe make it personal for you and me. In verse 12, Paul says this: don't let anyone look down on you because you're young. Now just freeze that frame in your mind for a moment. I want you to just meditate on this sentence and imagine someone's writing this to you. Don't let anyone think a certain way about you. Does that sound doable to you? That you're going to not let someone think a certain way about you? What are you going to do? Go punch them in the face if they don't think the way that you want them to think? And if you do punch them in the face, how is that going to affect the way they think about you? All of a sudden, they're just going to go, I was wrong. I love you. You're wonderful. How do you make someone else do something? We're going to talk about that in a minute because Paul, it's interesting where Paul goes right after this little phrase here. But notice what he says. Don't let them think a certain way about you, looking down on you or whatever, in a derogatory way. Don't let them think these ways about you because you are young. Now, why would Paul have to write something like that? Don't let anyone look down on you because you're young. Well, perhaps the reason Paul had to write something like this is because there were, in fact, people that were looking down on Timothy because he's young, inexperienced, just a kid. What does he know? I don't have to listen to this guy. And it made me think about the generation gap. You know what the generation gap is? It's this communication thing that just doesn't quite connect because old people and young people. I've got three boys, and man, I'm telling you, we're different generations. We really are. And so, and if you're not careful, that generation gap can cause friction, and then you despise each other because I'll tell you what. I have four photographs or pictures here I want to show you, cartoons and stuff. I just want to show you that kind of depict what I'm talking about here of the generation gap, okay? So I'm not going to give a lot of explanation. You just look at the picture and try to get the point here. Here's the first one, generation gap. Do you see the difference? Okay, so that's pants. How about the next one? Yep. And Christmas. On the left it says, Dad, can you help me? My new toy car needs batteries. On the right it says, Son, can you help me? My new tablet won't sync with my laptop. Can I just tell you that every time okay, real quick, just on this topic, every single time, this is not an exaggeration, literally every single time I would go to visit my mom and my dad, who are now in their 80s, every single time I'd go, and we'd get there maybe a couple times a year. They live in Iowa. It's about a 12-hour drive from here. And every time, did you hear me? Every time I'd go there, they'd want me to update their Windows and do their, you know, virus test and sync all their stuff because their things quit working on their computer, and they couldn't. How do I get email? I can't get email. And it got to be where I didn't want to go visit my parents anymore. Because here's the deal, okay? They lived 7 miles out of town. They didn't have cell phones. They had dial-up, and they had Windows 98 for 30 years, I swear. So I would go there, and the Windows essentials needed to be updated. But what would happen is my parents didn't want anybody stealing their sensitive information. So they would log on long enough to get their four emails and shut it off. Well, you know, if any of you who are techie know, the minute you log on, Windows is working behind the scenes going, hey, we need an update. Your security stuff needs updated, and we got to do this. So we're going to download 400 trillion megabytes onto your computer, 1 megabyte at a time over dial-up, and then they would shut it off as it got midstream. So then they'd have one update backed up, and then I'd show up, and they'd have like 7 of them. They would need all these updates done on a slow, and I kid you not, there were times I packed up the monitor, put it in the truck. I'd go get the CPU unit, put it in the truck, get the keyboard and the mouse, put it in the truck, and I'd drive into town and go to the coffee shop so I'd get on Wi-Fi and download it in 4 minutes. Because at the house. Okay, so you get it. So then one day, I tell my parents, how about we get you an iPad? Ooh, and now the debate begins. Windows or Apple? The debate settled in my mind. I bought them Apple, and I never have to do updates for them anymore. It's genius. Thank you. All right, so anyway, generation gap. Here's the last one that it hits a little bit close to home. All right, so you get the point, right? Paul says, look at verse 12 again, and then what he says the rest of this verse. Don't let anyone think less of you because you're young. And why would he say that? Well, because that's part of the deal. And unless we're intentional about trying to build bridges with people who are different than we are, there's going to be a gap. I forced myself to learn to play video games so I could connect with my three sons. And I wanted desperately for them to just love Asteroids, right? It's just a knob and a button. No, they wanted to play the thing that has like 72 finger coordinates that you got to do to... I play my son in NFL, you know, the football game on Xbox. And I'd finally figure out how to make my guy go with the ball. And then my son would like... I would go to tackle him, for example, and then my son would do a spin move and then run to the end zone. And I'd be like, how did you do that? Oh, well, you got to put your pinky here, hold your left foot over here, do the... And I'm like, no, right? But if we're not intentional about trying to build relationships with people, the conflict, the gap, it creates a problem. And Paul says, don't let anyone think less of you just because you're young. So for those of you who are young people here this morning, this should be a great encouragement to you. But the question is then, how do you make people not think this way of you? Because there's only so much control you have over how to make other people think a certain way of you. So what Paul does is he doesn't focus on the things that you can't control. He's not telling them, like, get into their head and rewire the things so that they think a certain way. What he says is, let's focus on the things that you can control. And then he says this. Be an example. See, that's something you can control. No matter what your age is, no matter what the gap is, no matter what the differences are between you and another, you can impact your own behavior. So focus on that. Be an example in these areas, in what you say. Why would that matter? Well, have you ever been criticized and then let words fly that you just kind of let loose? Yeah, be an example in what you say, because Timothy probably was wanting to say just whatever came to his mind. Snappy, sarcastic, whatever it might be. But that can get you into trouble. So Paul says, you be an example in the things that you say. And not only that, be an example in the way that you live, because the way that you live can basically shut down, no matter how good your teaching is, no matter how many right things you can tell other people and how accurate you might be of your view of the world, if what you say doesn't match up with how you're living is going to override the things you're saying. So he says, watch what you say, but also watch how you're living, because your message, as good as it might be, is going to be ignored if you aren't living in a certain way. So then he goes on to say, be an example not only in what you say and how you live, but in your love. Because when you've been insulted because you're young, one of the first things to go out the window is love. And you get into self-defense mode, and you put up walls, and you keep people out, and you punch them when you get an opportunity, you get them back, you revenge, all those kind of things, right? So be an example in your love, because love doesn't happen by accident. You have to be intentional about this, so keep a watch on this. Not only in your love, but in your faith. Your relationship with Jesus, the trust and confidence you have in Jesus Christ, you keep that there. Because in the middle of feeling insulted, rejected, all those things, one of the first things to go can be your relationship with Jesus, because you're going off on your own tangent in your reaction to being hurt by others. And your faith, your personal walk with Jesus, your trust in him can begin to waver, right? So keep a watch, be an example in this area. And then finally, in your purity. Because here's the thing, when everything else begins to slip in your life, when what you say doesn't measure up, when what you do doesn't measure up, when how you love and how you walk with Jesus, your faith, when those things don't line up, purity goes out the window too. So keep a watch on all these things. Be an example to these. So Paul is wanting Timothy, I want you to think about it this way. Paul is wanting Timothy to own his current church circumstance. Because the temptation for Timothy is, I'm just going to rent this, and the minute it gets hard, I'm moving. But all of these encouragements to Timothy are, no, it's not how this works. You need to be invested. All in. I know it's not perfect. I know it's going to require maintenance and work and updating and effort. All that. I know it's going to require resources and inconvenience for you. I know it is. But don't walk away. Stay and invest. Ownership versus renting. Paul continues to challenge Timothy to engage instead of escape in the next couple of verses. In verse 13, he says, until I get there, focus on these things. Reading the scriptures to the church, encouraging the believers, and teaching them. Those three things, not that long ago, I was just in my own talk with the Lord trying to, you know, give a little, am I doing okay? Am I doing what you've asked me to do? And by the way, what did you ask me to do again? Because I can be pulled in 1,000 directions. I get excited about a lot of different things. And all of a sudden, I can get distracted by good things, but not the best thing. And so I'm reading Timothy, because that's a letter to pastors, which is what I do. And I came across this verse, and I thought, well, that's the three things I need to focus on. This is it. This is my responsibilities, is to continue to read the scriptures to the church, to encourage believers, and to teach. Those three things. Paul says, engage, don't withdraw, engage. So focus on those things. Notice verse 14, do not neglect. Engage, right? Don't neglect the spiritual gift you received through the prophecy spoken over you when the elders of the church laid their hands on you. Now, what that is a blessing and a prayer of commitment and setting aside. This is what they would do. The elders would lay their hands on the pastor and dedicate him for the ministry, kind of a thing. And Paul's saying, when that happened, when you were recognized as a elder quality, a pastor quality person, then the elders put their hands and prayed over you, and the gift that had given you that they were recognizing was this gift of pastoring and teaching, shepherd teaching. He says, don't neglect that gift. Again, the temptation is to walk away when things get hard. And he's saying, no, you don't do that. Remember that day when those guys prayed for you, they're recognizing the work of the Spirit in your life and that God had given you a gift and he wants you to use that gift. Use that gift. Don't neglect it. Engage. Don't escape. And then in verse 15, the last verse here, give your complete attention to. That sounds a lot like the other words he said. Focus. Don't neglect. Give your complete attention to these matters. And then throw yourself into your tasks so that everyone will see your progress. Okay? You get the little verbs he's using there? They're all words kind of getting behind him as a coach and going, give him a little kick in the seat and saying, get back in there. I know you're tired. I know you don't like it when the old guys are grumpy and think you're just a bunch of nonsense because you're young and all that. But don't pull back. See, you need to own your current church circumstances instead of renting it. You've got to invest, even though I know it's hard, even though it's going to require resources, all those things, invest. There's a quote from the book that we're studying together, and the quote goes like this. If you see yourself as an owner of your group, and I would add your church, if you see yourself as an owner of your group, you will take the assignments seriously. You will show up on time. You will work to make the group a success. But if you're only renting space, you won't be motivated to invest yourself. You may go along for the ride, but when the group hits a pothole or some maintenance is required, you may choose to look for a new group rather than to get under the hood and help make repairs. I love that illustration, partly because I'm a car guy and I love car illustrations. but also because I grasp the concept that they're talking about in this book, is that everything you own owns a part of you. And if you own the church, it's if you own it, your church, your group, if you own it, it's going to require something of you just like everything else you own. How many of you own a house and have not had to invest money and time into it? How many of you own a car and have not had to invest money and time into it? How many of you own a family? Right? You can't rent a family. You belong there. Some of us wish we could rent a family, but you belong there. How many of us who actually are in a family, it doesn't require time and money and investing? Everything you own owns a part of you. And what's I think happened in our culture is we viewed it as a rental. The word I would use is we're consumers. We're here to get. And if we could get a good bargain, all the better. Nothing's required of me. I just got to show up and I can wear flip-flops and shorts. And then they have really rockin' music. And the preacher's whatever, great. And I don't have to give anything or do anything. Nothing's required of me and I can call it church. And we've done that. We've played that for a long time. And the life change for the people who are in that kind of a club and the impact on our messed up culture, the influence on our culture is predictable. It's predictable. We're not making a dent. And people in the church are struggling with things just as much as people outside the church. When Jesus talks about he came to give us life and life abundant, I've wondered this many, many, many times about my own life, but I've wondered it also about just in general in church. If Jesus came to give us the abundant life, where's this abundant life that he talked about? Because I'm not experiencing it personally. For years I didn't. And I'm not seeing it in the lives of the people that I know who are walking with him or say they are. Where's the joy? Where's the peace? Where's the passion? Where's the love? Right? Well, I think it comes back to we've kind of just been renting space for a generation or so now. And I think Jesus is stirring in our midst, not just here at Grace Fellowship, but in our culture, that there's got to be more. There's got to be more than this, right? There's got to be more. The good news is, I can tell you with great confidence, there is more. There is. He really does bring abundant life. He really does. His life within us really is a wellspring that never runs dry that you can draw from again and again and again. But if you're trying to do the Christian life on your own, you're going to be thirsty and not understand why am I still not satisfied in the Christian life? Okay, look at how Paul describes what should be normal for the church in Ephesians 4. Here's what he says. He makes the whole body, talking about Jesus, he makes the whole body fit together perfectly as, look at this, each part does its own special work. Invested. Ownership. Each part working. And that's the picture. As each part does that, it helps the other parts grow. See, this is healthy. So the whole body is healthy and growing and full of love. It requires a commitment to each other and an ownership to the point where you go, yep, something's required of me and I'm going to invest. I'm going to give. All right? Each member is equally responsible for ensuring the group is honoring to God, accomplishes the thing God intends for us in the context of Christian relationships, including how much fellowship is happening. We looked at that word last week. What does fellowship mean? If you're looking for fellowship and you're expecting other people to be responsible to make it happen for you, well, I can predict how much fellowship you're going to enjoy. Not much. Okay? It's not just the responsibility of the leader or the pastor or the elders to make it happen. We all have to be invested in it. And again, I come back to this whole point of we have groups, but that's not, it's not if you didn't sign the dotted line to sign up for a group that you're not invested in fellowship. But at some point you go like, well, if you're not doing that, what are you doing? Anything? Because fellowship is each one of our responsibilities to help build up the church and make it healthy so that it becomes a place where it's full of love, which will change the world, which will change our own hearts. It really will. Small group job description was in the book. And there's a number of things, and I just want to highlight two of them. The small group member job description was to build meaningful relationships with other members of the group outside of the scheduled group meetings. Build meaningful relationships with other members of the group outside of scheduled group meetings, which requires clearing your calendar and making time for people. A second thing on the job description was to open your life to others by being honest, transparent, and teachable. Only through your enthusiastic involvement will the church or your small group be able to really do everything God's called and equipped us to do. Building relationships in small group will not happen unless the entire group is committed to making it happen. Peter puts it like this in 1 Peter 4:7. We'll end with these couple of verses and these thoughts. In 1 Peter 4, I love this. Peter says, the end of the world is coming soon, period. And that was, again, written 2,000 years ago. How much more soon is it? It's soon. And so because the end of the world is soon, it should change your behavior in light of that. So Peter goes on to say, therefore, be earnest and disciplined in your prayers. Most important of all, continue to show deep love for each other, for love covers over a multitude of sins. Cheerfully share your home with those who need a meal or a place to stay. God has given each of you a gift from a great variety of spiritual gifts. Use them well to serve one another. Because the end of the world is coming, invest in these relationships. And why would Peter say that? Because the end of the world is coming. What does it have to do with relationships? Oh, I'm glad you asked. Because Jesus had something to say about the end of the world and relationships. He had a lot of things to say about it. But I wanted to share one verse with you. Here's what Jesus says about the end of time. Matthew 24, verse 12. Sin will be rampant everywhere. Have you been looking? Sin will be rampant everywhere, and the love of many will grow cold. I think cold is a word I would use to describe the culture out there. And it's getting colder all the time. When I'm talking about love, it's getting cold, really cold. It's not going to get better, folks. Don't put your hope in cultural change without Jesus, because it isn't going to get better. Paul repeats this same idea in his letter to Timothy the second time, 2 Timothy chapter 3. And we'll finish with this. You should know this, Timothy, that in the last days there will be very difficult times. For people will love, notice what they'll love, only themselves and their money. That's it. And if that doesn't describe the world we're living in, I don't know what does. People will love only themselves and their money. They will be boastful and proud, scoffing at God, disobedient to their parents, and ungrateful. They will consider nothing sacred. They will be unloving, unforgiving. They will slander others and have no self-control. They will be cruel and hate what is good. They will betray their friends, be reckless, be puffed up with pride, and love pleasure rather than God. They will act religious, but they will reject the power that could make them godly. What's the power that makes us godly? It's the Holy Spirit. It's Christ's righteousness in me that makes me holy. It's going through the motions of religious stuff, but rejecting the power that could change them and make them holy or godly. Stay away from people like that. That's Paul's final word on that deal. Stay away from them. But you see, the end of the world is coming soon. So invest in Christian relationships, because we're going to need each other more and more and more as the world goes nuttier out there. We are going to need each other more and more to not lose our bearing and to not be isolated and left alone, because the enemy, once we're alone, we're vulnerable to the enemy's attacks in our life. Okay? Do not, here's my final encouragement, don't rent your space in church. Own it. And this morning, we're going to finish with coming to the communion table. And I think it's very fitting that we would do that after a message like this about relationships, because here's the deal. We're told when we come here that we're supposed to do it in remembrance of Jesus. And when we remember Jesus, we remember the greatest friend you will ever have. He was all in building a relationship with you, and it cost him very much. So when we do it this morning, we do it in remembrance of him and his love for us, and then we love him and each other because he first loved us. May the life of Christ and the love of Jesus permeate our hearts and spill over into each other. Let's pray together. Jesus, as we come to this table this morning, we are humbled because we know it's our failure and our sin that sent you to the cross in the first place. And out of just your sheer love for us, you came to this earth and gave your very life for us in a horrible, horrible way. The death on a cross. The amount of suffering that you experienced was a demonstration of how much passion and love you had for each of us. So as we talk this morning and we're reminded from your word about our need to be connected in love with one another in your church, it all starts with this. We don't share our love because we will run out, because people will rub us the wrong way. But what we share is the love of Jesus that's been poured into our hearts first because of the cross. And we want to share that love with those around us. So Jesus, come and minister to us in personal ways as we remember you this morning. In your name we pray. Amen.